Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, we have Vivian Goldman on the line. Are you there, Vivian?
Hello, Charles. Hello, Russ Charles, and hello, everybody listening.
Oh, boy. Well, Vivian, we've been playing and featuring some Bob Marley and rarities, actually, and we want to let the listeners know who you are, Vivian Goldman, and would you tell the listeners, first of all, who you are in the book that we're about to talk about?
Okay, as Russ Charles was saying, my name is Vivian Goldman. I'm a sort of writer, broadcaster, and musician type, and I had the privilege of, for many years, working with or being associated with Bob Marley, starting from 1975 through up until he signed off from this mortal coil, which was in 81.
Wow.
And, yes. And especially around the Exodus time, the time of his award-winning album, Exodus, I was really with them a lot, with Bob and the band. As a journalist, I traveled with them on the road, and they recorded the album just up the road from my flat or apartment in London. And I was there a lot, spent many a night there, having an extraordinary time listening to this music build, you know, from the bones up. So even now, when I listen to the album Exodus, I can sort of flash back in my mind and hear, oh yes, I remember that's when they tried this with the i3's background harmonies, and oh, they changed that, didn't they? Little flashes come back to me. And I wrote a book which is just coming out called The Book of Exodus, and it's coming out right now with Three Rivers Press, which is a part of Crown, which is a part of Random House. And, you know, writing the Book of Exodus was sort of an exodus in itself, in that I started to write what I thought was going to be a making of the album book, but then as things went on, I got really led on a journey. And it started because of, in a way, Family Man Barrett talking to me. Family Man Barrett is the bass player of the Wailers. And somebody was talking to me in the room just now. That's how really live we are. We're just informal, we're relaxed. It's as if you were all hanging out with me in my living room. That's how it is.
I love that style.
But he told me, you see, I don't know whether many people realize this. I've discovered this from sort of talking to people in America, but a lot of people seem to think that Bob Marley is some kind of genial pot-smoking ragamuffin or something like that, you know, all good vibes and one love. But that's not so. That was one of the many moods of Bob. But, you know, he was very much on the front line as an activist politically, and he actually was a victim of an assassination attempt which occurred in his home in Hope Road in December of 1976, just a couple of days after I'd been staying there as his guest, in fact.
Wow. You were there when all this stuff was taking part.
I really was, but I was like, you know, Miss Innocent, you know, kind of wandering in. And I did notice, I write in the book about something strange that I noticed very early one morning as I was looking out the window. I saw Bob in the yard, and there were these two sort of menacing, like kind of heavy-duty looking men talking to him very harsh. And although I was in the room just looking out into the yard, I could see there was a very tense conversation going on. And I couldn't hear the argument, but it just made this I said, something weird is happening here. And then just 2 days after, gunman broke into his house and tried to shoot him. And I feel sure, from the vibe that was so strong, from the body language and the hand movements and the gestures, you know, those were the people who were coming to shake down Bob and sort of menace him. I can go back and explain why it all happened, but basically, after this attempt on his life, he and the band sort of fled to London. That was somewhat their second home anyway. And in London, they recorded Exodus. And Bob was very conscious that he was on an exodus, you know, because a couple of years after all these events, I was talking to him again in Jamaica, and I didn't really register this till I was listening to the tapes a long time after, but he actually said to me, we were reflecting on that period, and he said to me, I was a stranger in a strange land. He just said it softly like that, throwaway. I was a stranger in a strange land. And of course that does come from Exodus. So he was so identifying with Exodus as he was in that traumatic passage or challenging passage. And what happened was, Family Man explained to me that while they were all there in London, he went to a record shop, one of the second-hand record shops in Soho, and he bought, you know, an album of movie soundtracks. And on that album was the theme from Exodus, right, written by Ernest Gold. And that is the theme music, the soundtrack, from a film called Exodus that was about Jews trying to get from Germany into Palestine, as it then was, and the British turning them away. And it was a very mythic tale of the underdog, you know, that became hugely popular. And actually that instrumental itself, the theme from Exodus, was a worldwide hit. And Bob's first single appeared on the B-side of Ernest Ranglin's version of Exodus, in fact. So they were listening to this grand, sweeping, epic theme from Exodus and reasoning about it. And sort of the next day or the day after that, Bob came back and started to sing to Family Man, Exodus, Movement of Jah People.
Key word, key word.
Yeah.
Movement. Movement is the key word there.
Yeah. Well, when I heard that, it sort of was astounded me, and I just started to think of the power of Exodus itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why in the book, in the end, the whole book became not only a making of the album book, which it is, with a story of how it was made and who plays what and the various technological breakthroughs that happen on the album, but also somewhat of a meditation on Exodus itself, which I kind of think Bob would have enjoyed, because he liked nothing more than a good reasoning around the Bible. So, you know, he would have liked nothing more really than to be discussing all the meanings of Exodus.
Mm-hmm,
and in
mm-hmm.
the book, I actually did get the opportunity to speak to Bob's Rasta guru, Mortimer Plano, who sadly just left us. And I feel so blessed that I was able to talk to Mortimer about the meaning of Exodus, just the sort of dialogue, you know, that Bob might have had, you know, the true Rasta meaning of Exodus. Anyway, so...
Well as you said, you can talk to rabbis, it's kind of similar, you know, the movement of Jah people, and that movement is all people, really.
Yes, well, not all people. I mean, it's all...
The
movement of Jah people.
Jah people, that's what I mean. Jah people.
You know, it's not the movement of, say, the Pol Pots of this world, say.
Definitely not.
Savage, brutal dictators. I don't really think it's their movement, actually.
No.
But neither do you.
But Jah people can be of all persuasions.
Oh, absolutely. What you mean in terms of being Catholic or Christian or Jewish?
Yeah, or whatever color you may be, that you can be your Jah people.
Yes, absolutely. It's more a question of ethics and values and morality.
And a universal message. The message of Bob was really a universal message, you know, for the downtrodden, you know.
Well, that's very interesting, because I always think that in a way his message treads on two tracks in a way, because he was seriously into sort of Pan-African, the black movement, black unity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was a huge thing for him, and yet at the same time he was also on the universal track, you know. I mean I remember there was one mix I heard where one song where he was saying, how long must they kill black people. And then in a later version of the song was changed to, how long must they kill our prophets? Or maybe it was black prophets. But anyway, he changed it to make it more universal. Not because he was trying to diminish the sort of pan-black message, but because he realized he just needed everybody to relate to it. And he made sure there was a lot of stuff was specifically relating to the African diaspora in all his his work.
And he was definitely trying to reach the African American market towards the end, definitely trying.
Well, not only towards the end, throughout that was one of his prime driving forces, you know. And it's interesting to note that when, you know, his body actually signed off, sort of thing, you know, he was in America, and he was pushing himself. He was determined to just reach as many people as he could with the very last ounce of strength that he had. It's very moving when you think about it, how he really gave his life.
Well, you know what I was saying, though, is that the music was not really promoted in the African-American community. Because when I remember the early 70s period, when they first came here, it was really the white college campuses that you would see Bob. I mean, I remember 1979 when I saw Bob at the Apollo. I remember a guy walking under the marquee. First of all, it was the most white people I ever saw in Harlem at the Apollo. And this guy said, "Who the heck is Bob Marley?" And that said something to me. If all these people know Bob Marley, how come we don't know Bob Marley, you know? And I was not one of many. When I was working with Jobs and I would play reggae music, African-Americans say, "Where you from, brother? Why don't you put on BLS?" You know, in that period. So it changed, and I guess I'm one of the people that's helped to change that, because reggae music saved my life, I tell people, Vivian.
Really? Oh. Yeah, well, he certainly sort of was committed to it, and in the book I do interview somebody called Lister Hee-Wan Lowe,
mm-hmm.
who was at the time doing the promotion for Ireland on the Exodus album, and he literally describes going around to the sort of whatever they call it, urban black, in quotes, radio station. I hate all these distinctions that they do in this country much more than in England, where I come from.
Mm-hmm.
And people sort of didn't want to know. And what I gathered from him and from talking to other African Americans who were trying to promote Bob, such as Tom Terrell at that time, there was a very protectionist attitude in black America. You know, because I think, well, we have, it seemed to be, the impression I get is that people, a lot of people, obviously not everybody, but many people were saying, wow, don't we have enough of a struggle getting ourselves out, our own culture out, in this white-dominated society,
mm-hmm.
without having this competition from these island people?
Well, I can see that. I can see that makes sense.
Yeah.
Economics, I mean, it happened. There's long been a schism between African Americans and Caribbean people, and there's been dialogue about it, continuous dialogue, and still needs to be more dialogue about it.
Yes. And would you say that relates to actual African people from Africa as well?
Definitely. I once asked a student, "Do you believe there could be dialogue between Africans from the continent, Caribbean, and African Americans?" She said, matter-of-factly, no. And well, she went into saying that African Americans think they went through slavery more than anyone else, and we have chips on our shoulders. And I said, well, maybe more than like a mountain, but we need to dialogue. We need to talk more. Why you have those thoughts? Why I may have the thoughts that I have? And that's the only way we can solve some of the problems or learn about each other, is to communicate and talk.
Don't you think it's a little depressing when people have to enter into this competition of suffering? Gosh, I suffer more than you. I think it sort of diminishes all our pain, really, when
Indeed.
It's used to that, you know. And yeah,
scapegoatism. Somebody yeah. always has to be the scapegoat, you know, lower than this, you know. It's like when people come to this country, there's always seek out for somebody lower than the people that's here.
I comment on human nature, and it's just the sort of thing that Bob really did reflect on a lot in his music, and you know, you can hear it very much in the Exodus album. I mean, in the book I talk about the Exodus. Well, it was a funny thing, really. I knew it so well, so intimately, and then, frankly, hadn't really listened to it for a while
mm-hmm.
until I sat down to write the book. And it was such a shock when I listened to it, because it was the first time I'd listened to it probably on a CD, actually. I knew it so well on the record.
Hearing that analog sound, yeah.
And not only that, it's the way it was structured, which actually was done by Chris Blackwell, the head of Island Records and an executive producer on that album. I think that was his title, but anyway, he was very, very involved on that album. He was a a serious producer of it, and he was in the studio a lot. And Bob and Family Man did agree to his track listing, to the running order that he set up. And it's an extraordinary thing, because when you heard it on a record, which has two sides, side A and side B, then you listen to the first side, and it's very challenging, and it's kind of about, as it were, people's inhumanity to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you get songs like Guiltiness. These are the big fish that always try to eat down the small fish. They would do anything to materialize their every wish. You know, these are the ruthless scum that orchestrate so much of the pain and difficulties that people have to live through, you know. And then Bob rouses the people with the heathen, where he's sort of vibing up his troops, you know, vibing up the troops. And then on the other side, you've sort of emerged from all the angst of side one into a more joyous, upbeat side, where you can allow yourself to feel love, you know, on songs like Waiting in Vain and Turn the Lights Down Low. And then, of course, it sort of climaxes with Three Little Birds and People Get Ready, One Love. And if any of you out there, you remember Three Little Birds,
mm-hmm.
it's almost become a sort of code for joy, hasn't it?
It really has. It really has.
You hear it and you know there's, yes, happiness, despite all this agony that exists all over, you know. There can be joy, and we can reach joy. And I think that is an enormous gift, because he wrote it, he was already sick. I'm not exactly sure he knew how sick he was, but he was sick with a disease that kind of carried him off. And, you know, he also had just undergone a hideous betrayal, because he knew that the people who came into his house at Hope Road to kill him were people to whom he'd offered hospitality in the past. Because at Hope Road, he tried to make a sort of safe house, a sort of enclave, where people from downtown who came from the two opposing parties, the JLP and the PNP, could really meet and he hoped find common ground.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what he'd hoped to do, but it was people he'd nurtured who actually just tried to remove him from the planet permanently.
That must have really changed him and how his runnings were from that time, and changed how his movements would be from the rest of his life, you know.
And it very, very much informed the Exodus album.
Yeah, I can see that. Well, it was the Exodus, and then the next one, Kaya, was that the same session, basically?
Absolutely, and in fact, some of them date from even before. Like,
mm-hmm.
I discovered that some of the music actually was first sketched out for Rastaman Vibration and first laid down, which is a previous album to Exodus. And Kaya got some flack and criticism for it had a lot of the more mellow and, you know, lovely sunshiny songs on it. And some people said, oh, Bob's not militant anymore, Bob's gone soft and all this business. But I remember talking to him, and he said to me, I'll never forget, he's like, somewhat plaintively, he says to me, how long must I sing the same song? In other words, he didn't want to be compartmentalized and shoved into a box. He was an artist.
Right.
And he'd say, you know, sometimes you've got to talk sweet to a woman. It's a part of life. You know. It's
most definitely.
Yes. Yes. Oh.
Yeah, I love him. I tell you, Bob Marley changed my life, you know. So I think 1975 was... I heard Natty Dread and haven't looked back since that time, and happened to see him one time at the Apollo in 1979 when he was there for that week, you know, one of the last before they tore the Apollo down, and that was just amazing for me. You know, I feel privileged. I feel privileged that I'm talking to someone like you that broke bread and, you know, and reading in the book when you came into the flat and Bob was sleeping upstairs and
oh, and I disturbed him, but he was so sweet.
Yeah.
He was like, I know, I promised to talk to you. Sit down, let me get myself together, we'll chat, we'll reason. He was very kind to me, and I mean, I can't believe it when I look back. You know, when I first started to think of doing the book,
mm-hmm.
I was like, well, what should this book really be? And as I explained to you, it grew while I was writing it. But even on the first sort of basic, basic laying it out, that period, because I decided to focus on that period really, between the shooting and the peace concert, which happened sort of 18 months later. So it's kind of narrow casting, looking closely at that period. And as I sat down and thought about it, I suddenly was, my goodness, I was there. You know, I was there A, I was there B, I was there tons. At all these pivotal moments, I said, I have to write this book. You know, I have to let people know, what it was like. And, and I discovered a lot more, Well, for a start, at the time, the story was put around that Bob was shot because he'd been implicated in a situation at the racetrack that a friend of his had got caught up in, some sort of, gambling shenanigans, mm-hmm.
Skill Cole, I think that's what they had said.
Yes, and who was a very, who's a very close friend of brethren of Bob's. But in fact, as I talked to more and more people, I realized that what had seemed the obvious backstory was really the backstory, which was that it was a political assassination attempt, nothing to do with just regular gangster stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it seemed very, at the time I said, well, if it was a political thing, it's hard even to say which side it was doing it, in the sense that people might have been trying to set up a situation where the blame would rest with the other party, as it were. Well, basically, let me put it simply. The time of Bob's shooting, he was trying to put on, he was putting on this concert called Smile Jamaica. And I was in the studio when they recorded this song, Smile Jamaica. The election time was coming up, which is always a very fraught time in Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a funny little song, Smile Jamaica, really, because it sounded like as if it was done by the tourist board, so sort of jolly and sweet, And after the session, I said to him, just what I said to you now, And he said, Jamaica has to smile. In Jamaica, people too vex. That's what he said to me. And that's because he was already getting this grief from people, like the people I saw through the window, that morning. And the party in power at that time was Michael Manley's PNP. And his opponent was Edward Seaga's JLP. Now, a lot of musicians were really backing Manley because, musicians are often somewhat liberal, and Manley was socialist and so on. And but Bob was trying very hard to divorce himself from the actual, A versus B dialectic,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He was trying to move the debate on to something where more people work together. But his concert that he was trying to do, Smile Jamaica, it was sort of co-opted by Michael Manley's people. It was made to seem as if it was definitely a concert that he was doing for the PNP, which was, terrible.
That's backstabbing. That's kind of a backstab.
It was, and it was ironic because he was pretty tight with Michael Manley. Michael Manley even used to go around and visit him at Hope Road and so on. But I guess politics is politics, and, Michael Manley was just doing what he felt he had to do, regardless ultimately of the consequences for Bob. Maybe he didn't even realize how high the stakes were, because it seems, 99.999, that it was people coming from the JLP to shoot Bob, and it seems that it was a reflection of the power struggle within the party,
mm-hmm.
because Bob had a very close brethren called Claudius Massop,
right.
who was one of the downtown dons on the Seaga side. And, what was different from just your run-of-the-mill gunman don type, Claudie Massop really believed that Seaga was going to do something great for the country and so on. And he was very close to Bob, and it seems that the more open and advanced his ideas became, the more he got resentment from within his own team. In a just a classic story of human nature, ruthless ambition that could be in a corporation, it could be in a university, and in this case it was in Kingston, Jamaica, you know, between the ghetto and the music scenes. So in fact Claudie was in jail when this hit occurred. Now in the book I do reveal that Claudie actually got to a phone inside the jail, and he was able to phone Bob and warn him that while he was locked up, he, Claudie, was locked up, the other people in his party were planning this hit on Bob.
Wow.
But Bob obviously felt, you know, Jah will work it out. I've got to do what I've got to do. So he carried on living his life of being an artist and being an activist. Because somebody told me, who was present in the room, that when Bob summoned Claudie and some other downtown dons to London to organize the peace concert, Claudie was they were sitting in a room, and Claudie sort of jumped up in his enthusiasm and his passion, and he said, and I'm not attempting to do the accent, I'm not that ridiculous, you know, and he says, and he said, Skip, because that's what we used to call Bob, Skip, if I was around, none of this would ever have been able to happen. But through, I was in jail, and I was locked up. So what happened is the person who was after Claudie's slot in the party, you know, who was a man called that they used to call Jim Brown, took advantage of Claudie being locked up, or maybe even operated to make sure that Claudie was locked up.
Power struggle, yep.
Correct. So Bob was to be the sacrificial lamb to all these people's greed and ambition. Can you believe it?
And that must have really infuriated Bob, really, I mean, once he found out all of this stuff, he had to be, just lose, and his own countrymen and the own people that he trusted. Wow. Heavy stuff.
It was very, very harsh.
And how long did he stay away from Jamaica?
Well, after the peace concert, he started to come back more, and his last years, you know, he was able to achieve a long-standing dream. Because, you know, Bob had been doing music all his life. When he burst on the international scene, he wasn't really a novice. He'd been at it for years, getting ripped off by one producer after another. You know, and so his dream was to, as Karl Marx put it, control the means of production. And so his latter albums, you know, such as Survival, which some close people around him love the best, partly because in a way they know that he was able to do it the way he wanted to. Finally, his latter recordings were done in his own home, in his own state-of-the-art studio. So, you know, he did achieve that. Junior Marvin, the guitar player of the Wailers, told me how Bob used to just, like, riff, you know, and describe to him his fantasy about how he wanted the studio to be. And he used to visualize, you know how positive visualization can help and work, right?
right.
So Bob also used to do positive visualization, and he would rap to Junior about how the very, you know, the different bits and bobs, you know, the faders and so on, the actual recording equipment would be made out of gold.
Wow.
Yeah.
I want to throw in your connection with punk music because of simply that tune, Punky Reggae Party, because, you know, Ari of the Slits was talking to me about that. So I want you to tell the listeners about that connection.
Okay. Well, at the time, it was all very Jah, you know, karmic, you might say. At the time that Bob, who was already familiar with London, spent quite a bit of time there and recorded Exodus, London was very seething with creativity and with various sorts of stress. You know, it was really a town on the edge at that point. For a start, there was a lot of IRA activity, there was a lot of bombs, there was a lot of unemployment, much more than there'd been before in recent memory. it was very fraught. There was a lot of aggro, as they called it, fighting on the streets, a lot of fighting on the streets between punks and skinheads, between Teds and punks, and of course there was the National Front, which was then really gathering strength, which tragically I gather is gathering strength again in England. And the National Front, of course, were very anti-immigrant, and they were very anti-black and anti-Jew, and, you know, much as they, you know, much as they've been throughout history. And so Bob found himself in the middle of this sort of cauldron, very dynamic, very creative, and lots of music coming out, and there was this punk movement where people would go around looking kind of shabby or ill-kempt, not very polished and like yuppies and no bling bling, you know. It was a very different aesthetic. It was like a front line, you see. And at first Bob was sort of startled by some of these people, their weird hair and their weird piercings and odd tattoos and so on, and he said to these, like, to me, well, who are these people? What is it? You know. And I said, you know, I said to him, no, there's really a big connection between punk and Rasta, because it's both like the voice of the underdog, you know, the suppressed, the people in France, you call it les marginaux, you know, the marginal people, the people who the system doesn't want to have a voice, you see. And of course, the Rastas were the same thing in Jamaica, where they'd been called Black Hot Man and were very much living on the edges of society and a couple of rungs below the ladder of success.
Right, you know? right.
And so I remember going round there with the Clash's album, where they'd done a version of Junior Mervyn's Police and Thieves, that was produced by Lee Perry, Lee Scratch Perry, the formidable Jamaican producer. And so Scratch and Bob were both there, because Scratch was staying in this flat apartment upstairs from the studio. And they were like, my goodness, because it was so different, you know. Joe Strummer sort of rasping, you know, tuning was not his forte, of Joe Strummer. You know, like Bob was always trying to get the right pitch, the right tune, whereas with Joe it was just all about the feeling, rasp it out, you know. And but they got it. I mean, straight away Bob and Scratch got it. They said, wow, you know, there's something strong in this. And then later Bob recorded Punky Reggae Party, which again I do go into in a fair amount of detail in the book. Yeah, so it was a beautiful effort. It's not, frankly, one of my favorite of his songs, and it seemed almost like it was a bit thrust upon him because some of his phrasing is not his finest phrasing, you know, not as great as he normally is when he works so hard on it. But still, it stands as an extraordinary testament to, you know, a commonality between sufferers.
The strugglers.
I night,
all over the world.
That's yeah, absolutely.
So Vivian, have you been, the book has just come out, right?
Yes.
And where, can you let the listeners know where, who published the book and where they can get access to the book, or what website?
Absolutamente. Well, for a start, it's called The Book of Exodus, The Making and Meaning of Bob Marley and the Wailers, Album of the Century. And it's, my name is Vivian Goldman, and it's published by Three Rivers Press, which is, you know, under the Random House umbrella. Now, I'm a great believer in supporting your local bookshop if at all possible. You know, it's so depressing to see everything go to big boxes or just bookstores vanish. But whatever your local bookstore is, ask for it. If it's not there, hopefully it should be there. I've seen it in Barnes and Noble and places like that. And otherwise, you can buy it online, obviously, like at Amazon. And I have just, with the help of my friends, because I could never have done it alone, but just started to set up a viviangoldman.com, and that's V-I-V-I-E-N, G-O-L-D-M-A-N. So, and that sort of directs you to other things like my MySpace site and so on. I'm going to try and grow it and put more things up there, but at the moment it's just a little toddler starting out. But if anybody wants to communicate with me, that's the way to do it, via the MySpace and so on.
And if someone wants to have Vivian Goldman as a possible teacher, where are you teaching, Vivian?
I do teach at the Clive Davis Department of Recorded Music, which is part of NYU's Tisch School of the Arts. And I'm just an adjunct there. I teach two courses, punk and reggae. And I finished the reggae one recently, and I'm shortly going to do another punk one, and then early next year I'll be doing a more extended reggae one that actually will probably extend into the areas that I covered in my previous book that I did with the photographer David Corio called The Black Chord. And that was really a book about kind of the tree of music, Pan-African music, music in the African diaspora, frankly mainly concentrating on the English-speaking territories, wee bit of French, you know. So it's not totally encyclopedic, but it does really cover the arc of music in the black diaspora within a somewhat limited context. So I think that my next course that I'm meant to be starting in January will be more like that, and that will be a longer course. So
I have a question.
Yeah.
Why do you think, and I hear this from the artists, that reggae music is much more accepted or respected, the artists feel respected in Europe in general? Now, I won't even say England, but not so much in England now, but France is, whoa.
Well, France is I think, the biggest market for Jamaican music in the world, isn't it?
I think so, right now, yeah.
Well, you know, France is a case on its own, because France is a place, you know, even though it was a sort of grotty colonizer with all the things that happened in Algeria and so on, nonetheless, the fact remains that they've always been eclectic and open-minded and receptive on a cultural level in Paris. I mean, look at, rather in France, but, you know, obviously Paris being the capital is the highest concentration of activity. You know, you only have to look back and see in the earlier part of the 20th century all of the many black American people who went to live there, you know, James Baldwin, Bricktop opening the nightclubs there, because they were accepted there.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to be free and without always like the burn of, oh, what color am I? If I'm this color, I'm going to suffer. And it was much freer. People were much more receptive. You know, they appreciate South American music. They appreciate music from around the world a lot in Paris. And generally, again, if you look at the situation in England, Jamaican music is totally interwoven with the culture, because from Jamaicans started arriving in any numbers in say the 50s, although it really started a wee bit before, as it went on through all the race riots and so on. But because of the strength of the culture and the music and the style and the general fabulousness of Jamaica in many ways, they came to be sort of the dominant kind of the dominant cultural influence in a way of people from the former colonies, and everybody just loved it. You know, even people who hated black people, like the skinheads, still loved the music and danced to the music and paid good money for the music.
I got to tell you this, Vivian. Larry McDonald, who's actually is playing with Dub as a Weapon with Lee Scratch Perry, said when he would go to with the Slackers in Germany, they said the irony is looking at these skinheads with a Jamaican flag.
So
he would ask the club owner, is it cool, man? Because I don't know. I mean, the guys, you know, they got a Jamaican flag, skinheads, and, you know, are they ready to take my head off or what?
No, it's very, very complex, isn't it?
It is.
And people's motivations and why they turn on other people and project onto other people maybe their own feelings of inadequacy and, you know, prefer to project them onto others than deal with it within themselves, you know? it's very complex, and that is an area where you see it a lot, in just that sort of image that you describe, the skinheads who would, you know, might come from setting, you know, as happened in Russia, you know, a hostel of African students on fire because they don't want black people in their country, but yet at the same time they may love Bob Marley. That is the irony of it.
Wow, it's crazy madness. The world is gone mad. Well, Vivian, this has been a very instructive interview. I think it's not an interview. This is just we just, like you said, got together and started chatting. And this is how I feel. And
absolutely.
Very enlightening. And there's more. I mean, there's so much more that we could talk about Bob, you know. It's amazing. But people need to get the book.
Oh, I hope people get the book. I would love to be able to share this story, you know. It was such a huge thing for me writing this book. It took so long, and I'm so passionate about it. I do hope that other people will get to read it and you know, maybe learn something just the way I learned something while writing it.
Wow. Now, what year, 1975 is when you first, you went to Jamaica and met Bob there?
No, actually what happened was I was not long out of university. And I basically, you know, I was always somebody who loved music, and my father was a musician, so we used to have a lot of music in the home. You know, he was a violin player,
mm-hmm.
So music was really in me, sort of thing, anyway. And I just got this job, the way one gets a job. I got a job working at Island Records with special responsibility for Chris Blackwell's sort of key artists, which were Bob Marley and the Wailers, Aswad, and Burning Spear.
Wow.
That was my special responsibility. But the funny thing is, although, as I said, you know, although obviously the West Indian community and the students and the Bohemians and the hipsters, you know, were into the music, the mass media really weren't. It's hard to imagine how I had to get on the phone and wheedle and beg and whatever. And in the end, when some people wouldn't run something on Bob, and I remember going over their heads to the publishers and saying, no, you really have to deal with this, you know. And in the end, I was able to get him on quite a few front covers and so on, so I was able to play a little part in getting him out there. After that, he did the live album with a No Woman No Cry that became a very big hit, and things really opened up for him. So after I'd helped, sort of, as it were, get Bob away at that point, that was it for me in PR. I said, well, how often does a PR just get to sell something they're so passionate about as I am about Bob? And I was always really into writing, so I then just became a full-time writer and got to work with Bob even more. You know, as a journalist, I think, I'm not sure, but it's very likely that I wrote more articles with Bob than anyone else. I think so. Put it this way, any time you look at anybody else's books on Bob, it's all full of bits from my articles, because there was a lot of them. Well, not that many, but compared to, you know, it was just my blessing that I got to do that, you know?
Wow. What was your favorite cut on the Exodus album?
Okay. I always wonder whether it's my strict Jewish background, but it's, you know, I don't really have a favorite, but I really love Guiltiness. Maybe it's the guilt factor of my upbringing, Golden Screen, I don't know.
well, you know what? That's the cut we're going to go out on today.
Oh, and you know, also I was there when he was working it out.
Ah,
when he was writing the song.
That's a heavy song. You know, you know what? Those words he said, you don't have to say nothing else. That's it, Guiltiness, and that says it all.
Oh, I can see you did read the book. That's what he said to me. Yeah. That is what he said to me.
Yep.
Say no more. Guiltiness rests on the conscience. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Serious thing. So, listen, we're going to play some more music, and we're going to play that particular cut, because that is a poignant cut in this time. And Vivian, we will be talking, and this is going to be posted on radioforall.net. I'll let you know when it's done.
Oh,
and
fabulous.
And I'm sure there's web listeners that really appreciate this interview and have learned some things, and as I have today. And I want to thank you again, Vivian.
Well, I want to thank you. It was my privilege to talk to you, really.
Well, you know, hail up, David. And
absolutely.
We'll be in touch, and you'll get a copy of this whole show, actually. And check this out.
Beautiful. One love.
Every time, sis. Thank you, Vivian Goldman. Thank you, Robert Nesta Marley. Tell him.